4:30 this morning. It was pretty darn nice out there. It was kind of warm. It was, you know, sitting on the back porch enjoying the coffee, and all of a sudden then the rain came through, and high winds, rain, and it's getting colder by the minute. Fish and Frank here, Robert in the chair across from me, and RJ in the control center itself, the head of the operation, the key coordinator. I was looking for things that would rhyme with key, Robert, and it didn't work. Not a bit, not even a little.
Kind of like orange.
Yeah, yeah, I was kind of stuck in the orange world. And let's see, Jack Crevel in the canals. We got Jacks in the PGI canals, Jacks in the Port Charlotte canals. A lot of Jacks going on right now, even some up the river, aren't there?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of getting some good mixed reports on them of all sizes, from 2 pounds up to as big as 15 pounds. And people are catching them while trolling through the canals. We've talked about it with Carl, with him catching them on the bottom while trying to fish for black drum and other stuff. A couple guys been doing the same thing. And then up there, kind of by your place, up on the upper Peace River, well, lower Peace River, I guess, on the other side of I-75, they've been getting a few up in there, especially heading towards Shell Creek.
Now, the ones up in the river, we don't get it. We got probably one or two nice schools of them. A little harder to find, but they're bigger fish.
Usually,
they
usually
are somewhere in that 10-pound range, give or take a bit, you know, but
really fun size.
Yeah, they'll destroy your reels for you very quickly. They're awfully wonderful. I like those. They're good for business.
Yes.
Destroy a reel. Come in and get another one. Then it'll work.
Yeah, job security.
Yes, Robert needs the paycheck, so, and I'd like one. it's been a couple of months.
All right.
Let's see, but Jack's right now, for the smaller, probably more readily available Jacks in that 2 to 5 pound range, 1 to 5 pounds, you're probably talking a something small, I would say, trolling, like a XR6 or maybe an 8.
Yeah, 6 or an 8, but also a couple of guys have been catching them on rattle traps.
Rattle traps is always good. Now, to me, it'd have to be like a quarter-ounce rattle trap instead of the bigger ones.
Right.
Or what do you think? Do you think a half or three-quarter-ounce would hit those little ones like that?
I think they would hit it, but I'm going to stick more with the quarter ounce personally, just because there's times where I'm adjusting my speed a little tiny bit, and sometimes that bigger rattle trap wants to sink a little fast on me and get hung up.
Yeah, I don't pull those back as far behind the boat as I do some, because I need the rod to actually be lifting it up as I'm, you know, trolling forward. I don't want it diving down as far. So traveling in the canal 2-3 miles an hour, having a little heavier action rod, not for the fish, but to keep that lure kind of being pulled upward rather than just forward where it can get so much depth, because a lot of our canals only got 4 to 6 foot of water in them.
Right.
So that quarter ounce rattle trap, little tighter rod, which means it's higher in the air. You know, the lighter the action of the rod, the more the rod will bend with the lure, the lower the tip of the rod would be to the water. So I'm trying to use a little stiffer action rod to keep it up higher from the water so it pulls up more. RJ, what's your favorite color rattle trap?
I like that blue and white one.
Blue and silver?
Blue and silver, yeah. That's the one, yeah.
I knew what you meant. I can decode.
Yeah, thank good.
Yeah, I have an Enigma machine over here. I can decode this.
You can tell I'm not in the retail side of it. You know, I don't know the numbers, but I know what I like. And I know it works. And I think for Jack Revelle, the blue always seems to do the best.
So you like the silver with the blue back?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty classic. Robert, your favorite?
It's my favorite one, honestly.
Silver with the blue back.
Yeah, caught my very first redfish on it. Caught probably my third biggest snook ever on it. So it's just kind of been my staple kind of confidence lure.
Yeah, I like the silver black. I'm not a big fan of the silver blue, but the silver black and that bleeding shiner one.
Bleeding shiner.
That one to me is just
awesome.
Kind of looks like a maybe a pinfish, maybe, I don't know, but man, I've caught a lot of fish with that one.
That's a good consistent seller for everybody, freshwater and saltwater across the board, that bleeding shiner.
But you guys both picked chrome with blue, so, you know, I'll go along with that.
We should do a show at some point where you pick our three best lures. If you only had three lures on an island, we've talked about this before, but really get down to it and why. Okay. Why we think that that's the lure that we want to use.
All right, so next week, your three best lures, if you can only have three lures that you're going to take, you're going to be stranded somewhere.
Or you got married.
Yeah, it's the only three you get. So you got, they got to be able to use freshwater and saltwater.
Okay.
Because you don't know where you're going to be.
Right.
So the three lures have to be good in freshwater, saltwater, and they have to be able to catch almost any fish there is.
No problem.
All right. So next week we'll go into that. Boy, we actually have a topic for next week.
You know, that's kind of scary.
Yeah, we're not going to be writing.
Will we remember that far?
Yeah, I doubt if we'll actually remember to do it, but it might happen. All right. Right now we got a lot of fish along the intercoastal area.
Yeah.
The harbor's doing okay, the Gulf's doing okay and all that, but, I mean, we keep hearing stories, big redfish on the intercoastal, is that still going on?
A little bit. It seems to have fizzled out a little bit this week, but I think it's because of the direction of the wind has made it a little tougher out there along the intercoastal and the passes, so I think that's why the numbers and topics have gone down a little bit with conversations.
There's been big redfish under the docks behind Cayo Costa, Captiva, Little Gasparilla,
Lemon Bay,
Don Pedro, all these islands out there all have docks on the inside where people, you know, park their boats. And those are the places we're talking about. We're not talking about fishing piers. We're literally talking about little private docks. And I would say the best ones are where people have bigger boats tied up because they always blow holes underneath those docks, you know, as they're just putting a boat in forward and reverse. But big redfish, what else has been underneath those docks out there in the intercoastal?
Sheep's head.
A lot of big sheep head I'm hearing about.
Big sheep's head and big numbers, but it's funny because one dock will have a great number of sheep's head and the dock right next to it, you know, 40, 50 feet away, zero. Maybe a couple.
Did any fiddler crabs come in yesterday?
No.
No, not yet.
Not yet.
The cold weather and the storms making a problem getting fiddler crabs right now. But now, along the intercoastal, been any pompano out there?
None that I've heard of, but there's been some legal-sized gag grouper up to, like, 26 inches. There has been a couple
legal-sized, but out of season because they're closed.
Correct.
Okay.
There has been actually a couple of black sea bass that I've heard about from a couple different gentlemen,
now,
which is a little odd.
I got to tell you, what we want? 6-8 years and did not hear the word black sea bass.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you start to hear a couple in Boca Grande Pass, a couple here, a couple there, and now starting to hear that name again, black sea bass.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. It seems to go in little tiny spurts with those. There's also been some small black drum down in there. You know, basically 2 to 5 pounds, ones that a lot of people do get confused with sheep's head.
Right, the bearded sheephead is what the Marine Patrol calls them because they have a different size limit than the sheephead, and they look almost identical except sheephead have teeth, black drum have a beard, no big teeth sticking out. So if your sheephead does not have big teeth, it's a black drum.
Right, and I think it's like 13 stripes versus like 6 stripes.
I'm going to go with teeth. If you're out there, count the stripes for us. If you're out there and you're listening and you're on the Placida Trestle, catch yourself sheephead, count the stripes, and then catch yourself black drum, count the stripes. Let me know what that was.
Yeah. I just look for the whiskers.
I mean, he started it.
Yeah, I know. He did. He did, and then he let us finish it. So
it was like, okay, teeth, whiskers.
Sure.
No, let's count the stripes.
Sure, why not?
Okay, all right. Convict fish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what the nickname for sheephead is, because the old convict cartoon character, white and black stripes.
I thought he was talking about the prisoners in Arizona in Tent City.
No, they got pink uniforms on out there, don't
no,
they?
No, they wear prison stripes with pink boxers.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because it's hard to be a tough guy in pink boxers.
Yeah.
Okay. go, Sheriff Joe. I mean, you got to admit, if you're going to calm down a bunch of criminals, dress them in pink, because how are you going to be tough dressed in light pink?
Yeah, the only thing worse than that is a tutu.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, make the prison uniforms pink with tutus and stuff, and you'll have a lot less trouble. It's really hard to go, oh, I'm going to... Excuse me while I pirouette. Let's see. One thing I don't understand, and this is... we're going to go over some fish in the harbor and all that, but the intercoastal, where the vast majority of the best fishing has been, is where the worst of the red tide was.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that whole area sustained the worst possible.
From, you figure from Captiva, all the way up the ICW through Venice, all the way up now into St. Pete. The intercoastal waterway was decimated with red tide, you know, according to the news.
And then black tide.
Well,
at least in our area.
But the black tide happened a little more in the Gulf than in the intercoastal.
A little bit.
It was more of a near Gulf thing than an intercoastal thing.
True.
So, which was lucky, or there might not be anything there. But why are all the fish in the area kind of hardest hit by the red tide? Now, because according to the media, social media, the nightly news, that area, there's no fish. They're all dead. But
right.
The best fishing for the last 2 months now has been in the intercoastal. So, okay, RJ, a reason?
My first guess is always food. The red tide comes through, wipes out all the predator fish, leaves behind the fish that aren't, the critters that aren't affected by it, which are mainly shrimp and other small crustaceans, little crabs and things like that. So those guys get a double hit. Positive. They get dead fish to eat because that's what they eat. So you got a lot more of them. And their populations are grown because there's nobody there to eat them.
Okay.
So that'd be my first guess, is there might have been this large increase of food for predator fish to eat. So that's why they're all coming into the intercoastal. That'd be my first pass on it.
All right. Now, Robert, what's your first guess? Why are all these fish in an area that was hardest hit by the red tide? Why is it the best fishing?
Well, I really like RJ's answer unbelievably well. But another thought would be, you know, water temperature. You know, fish are cold-blooded, so they tend to seek out more comfortable water temperatures, you know, in order to process food and in order just to function life in general. So water temps would be another possibility.
Maybe there's this little bit of different temperature between the harbor and the Gulf, or...
Yeah, I mean, it's like, okay, your house, for example, gets almost twice as much rain as I do, and yet we're only separated by, what, maybe 10 miles as the crows flies?
No, about four or five miles as the crow flies.
So about 5 miles separates us. Now, there's certain areas with, like, with...
My house is also an average of 3 degrees cooler than the bait shop.
Right.
And when I go home at night, the temperature drops usually at least 3 degrees from when I leave the store to when I get the other side of I-75.
Yeah.
Some nights it's 4 or 5 degrees, but usually at least 3.
Right, and that's what I was going to get at, is like climates for plants, you know. My front yard will get maybe 1 freeze a year, period, versus my backyard won't, and because of me living on the canal, my back, you know, it creates a little thermal gradient back there that kind of protects my plants in my backyard versus the front yards get burnt. So who's to say that maybe there's not some kind of little phenomenon going on down there, because they only measure the Gulf temperature and most people kind of measure the harbor temperature as they're going in and out with their GPS. Are they actually checking maybe the temperature right there in that exact spot where there's maybe a little climate zone that has formed for some apparent reason where it might be 1 or 2 degrees different to keep those fish happy?
So Robert's theory is that an alien spaceship has created a
vortex.
Shield of vortex temperature right there in the intercoastal, which is making the fish stay there. Another guess would be salinity. But now, if you're going to fish in Charlotte Harbor, one of the things you need to keep up on is how much water flow is coming down the rivers. And I check fishandfranks.com, you go weather and tide button, then go down and click the Peace River button. And it was down to about 2.3 feet, 300 cubic feet a minute. It's back up to, it's raising back up to about 2.5, almost 3 feet now, and just a little less than 500 cubic feet a second. So there has not been, we had a pretty good push. The river went up to about 9 feet a few months ago. There was a little bit of salinity change in the harbor, but not a lot.
Not as much as you would have thought, as much water pushed through there.
The way I usually tell is by the water color. The browner it is, the more fresh water we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see a dramatic change in the color of the harbor, but there's possibility the salinity went down a little bit. Maybe that pushed the fish a little closer to the intercoastal.
Absolutely.
The salinity could have pushed them out there, or there could be this temperature thing.
I'd like to follow up on Robert's concept of the temperature. I heard a number of years ago there were people growing different types of tropical plants out on the islands along the intercoastal. And some of those islands would grow coffee plants that only grow in extreme tropical conditions, but they were having those conditions on a regular basis on the island. In fact, some of the islands, you grow it on one side, but you couldn't grow them on the other side. So I learned that there was a lot of microclimates down here in this area. The other thing about the intercoastal is it tends to be a lot shallower than the Gulf and the harbor. And I think I'm right about that. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, what I would say would probably be the best feature about it, the fish have access to very deep water in the ICW and very shallow water immediately outside of it.
They and the shallows warm up quicker, don't they?
20, 30 feet and go from 10, 15 feet of water to, you know, a foot and a half.
Yeah.
So I think the depth there might have something to do with it, or maybe not the depth, but maybe the varying depths that are so close together, because as the water gets colder, if fish go deeper, the water is not going to change as much. The deeper the water, the longer it takes for the temperatures to have an effect.
That's a good point that I think a lot of us don't know. You expect that the deeper water is going to be colder. But as you were saying, the thermal climb, when you get down far enough, the temperature stays stable.
But it would be cooler in the summer, but in the winter time, as now is winter time, it's January, technically this is winter. So it would actually stay warmer than what the very shallow water would get. People don't understand up north, the water only gets 32 degrees. It's the water's at 33 degrees, because if it gets 32, it turns to ice. So any of the water in the lakes and whatever up there where the fish are actually in are 33, 35 degrees. Whereas 2-3 feet of water here, we had a few years ago 29 degree weather. That first 2-3 feet of water went 29 degrees. That's what killed all the snook and all these other fish, because nothing lives in 29 degrees as far as creatures that we normally deal with, outside of, you know, weird organisms.
Right. No, there definitely could be all of that.
So maybe what's keeping a lot of those fish around the intercoastal is that it's very shallow right there, so in the afternoon, as the sun starts warming the water up, they can go right up onto the shallows, and then as night falls and it starts getting cooler again, they can drop down into that deeper water.
Absolutely.
So, now, RJ, do you think, what effect, well, you said, you know, you thought that the red tide was there. We talked a little bit about salinity and food. Actually, I guess this is a question for Robert. RJ was saying it might affect the shrimp. Is there anything else the red tide could have affected out there, Robert, as far as food-wise goes?
Well, with the decomposing fish, you know, settling on the bottom, It's going to basically put nutrients into the sand, which can make your little copepods, which are a little tiny, almost microscopic shrimp, your coquinas, which are a little tiny live clam or some kind of little shelled fish, sand fleas, sea cucumbers, starfish, all those are kind of more or less filter feeders that just kind of go through the sand feeding on stuff. So taking those nutrients out, providing more food for the whole environment as a whole, and, you know, it's
just that's not making a lot of sense.
Well, they're feeding on all of that. All those little critters are starting the basis of the food chain.
All right, but what are they feeding on? That's what I'm not getting what you're saying.
The nitrogen and the nitrates.
All right, where does this come from? I thought if there was red tide there, the red tide would have used up the nitrogen and nitrates and all that kind of stuff.
Not if it settled down inside the sand itself. If it settles down into the sand as those fish decompose, it's just like taking a rotting fish and throwing
Wait a minute. I think in your head you're thinking this is clear. But in my head, just to kind of clear it up, what you're actually talking about is not the red tide stuff. But when the red tide killed the fish, whatever else it kills, they go lay on the bottom dead.
Yep.
And as they decompose, that's the nitrates, nitrites that you think feed these other little tiny creatures.
Correct.
And so the actual fish that were killed went on to produce a massive amount of little tiny microscopic-ish creatures that would start the food chain going off.
Yes.
Did that make sense?
It did. And I think, you know, that's the cycle of nature, too. You've got all these little tiny things where you need billions of them to make a good ecosystem. And they're being eaten by things that are a little bit bigger than them and so on and so forth until we get up to the game fish that we're after. And red tide comes through, and yeah, it's horrible to see the dead manatees and dead dolphins and sea turtles and things like that. But there is a positive side to the red tide, if you can look at it that way, is it does regenerate the food chain.
So
it allows the little guys on the bottom to overproduce, which then gives more food to the fry, the smaller baby fish, that then grow up into something that we can catch and eat.
So we're not exactly saying that the benefits of a red tide outweigh the bad parts, because they don't.
We
lose a lot of big fish, a lot of fish that we could actually eat or enjoy, but not everything, and very, very few things, are all good or all bad.
Right.
We had to go dig around and to actually find out what would be the benefits of a red tide. Now, I would say, I'm going to propose a thought here. If you wanted to get rid of red tide, the easiest way to do it would be to dump truckloads of clams and oysters into Charlotte Harbor, the Intercoastal Waterway, filter feeders, because an average oyster, 30 to 50 gallons a day, Robert?
Yeah, one oyster can filter 30 to 50 gallons of water per day.
So
that's an astronomical amount for something that's only literally the size of maybe a quarter for as far as its body structure.
Yeah, 3/8 of an inch thick, big around as a quarter.
You know, to be able to do that in a day's time is pretty phenomenal. So the more of those filter feeders you have out there, they're absorbing a lot of those or cleaning up a lot of those nutrients that are flowing through the water. And
so
that could be a major food source for that red tide.
Cure the red tide with just clams and oysters?
I don't know about that one, but I think that it does lend some credence to some of the environmentalists that say stop digging up the oyster bars, you know, and reducing the number of oysters by channelizing and all the other things that we've been doing to the intercoastal.
Yeah, but the intercoastal was dug in 50-some years ago, or 100 years ago, and literally it hasn't been really touched much at all. And so whether you dredge the intercoastal or don't dredge the intercoastal, that would not have an effect on any oysters or growth anywhere except right in that channel, in my opinion. I don't know why that would be a big deal with the intercoastal channel. I don't see where that's a benefit or a detriment.
Yeah,
you might, and you can enlighten me.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna take your argument and turn it upside down here. There's probably plenty of oysters out there already. Can we actually increase the population of oysters and clams actually, and things like? Is there a way to increase their populations?
The only way I know is by putting more in, growing them in a farm setting, and then transplanting them out. Because
I have to say that this is a thought I had when I was in Japan. I got to visit the Yamamoto pearl farms. And they used to sell them as Mikimoto was the name. And that's a fairly famous pearl brand. And they have these giant oyster farms where they're growing oysters on ropes. Hundreds and hundreds of ropes with thousands of oysters on a rope. You know, and they pull it up, take the pearl out, blah, blah, blah. That water was always crystal clear, where the rest of the water in the harbor, you know, had that tannish, murky thing to it. So, yeah, those oysters were doing an incredible job of cleaning up all the effluent that was coming down the rivers at the time.
So, to me, if you want to cure red tide, it's not... Why couldn't we take, like, exactly as you said, I never thought about it, but they grow them on ropes. You could just put strands and strands of them along the inside of the intercoastal, and they actually, Robert, they reproduce by putting spores in the water to spread themselves, no?
Correct. Yeah, they put a little... basically a tiny baby clam out or baby oyster. It floats around or even swims around until it finds a spot that it wants to be, and then it glues itself to that spot, and that's where it stays for its entire life. Okay, it just slowly grows over time but never moves. Once it's glued itself, it's done.
So you could literally go out there and just put a buoy with a buoy and just rope after rope, you know, strands, and have them hanging down and literally put millions upon millions of oysters out there all trying to eat anything felt going through the water, which would include red tide algae.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that's why they close all shellfish consumption when there's a red tide bloom around, because they actually absorb those toxins into their muscle tissue as they're cleaning the water out.
One of the only ways humans ever get sick from red tide, unless you have one of the letter things with your lung, the CO and the, whatever those other letters are, or severe asthma, if you have major lung issues, you will have problems with red tide. But for most normal people, your throat scratches, you don't really get a big detriment from it. But if we could put enough oysters out there in just whatever form, because right now I read the red tide reports once, twice a week, and there's almost always background concentrations. Well, if we had enough clams and oysters out there, now we talked to Greg Palatka, who is one of the best scientists I know. He's one of the very few that I don't think are on an agenda trip. Right. You know, he's just a scientist.
Right. He works for FMRI, which is the Florida Marine Research Institute. So if you're out on the harbor and see some of those guys netting little fish and stuff, that's
one of their jobs. Yeah, they pull nets to sample fish. They do all kinds of stuff. But we asked him, is there a detriment to too many? What would it take for oysters to be a problem? You know, could oysters be a problem if you know you started putting in a truckload every week or every 6 months, just back a dump truck up onto a barge, take them out, and just dump them on hard bottom somewhere? Would that be a problem? And he doesn't seem to think that could actually turn into a problem. You know, just the more the merrier, really.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they've been doing studies all over the Gulf states and even on the Atlantic side with oyster renourishment programs, and there doesn't seem to be a downside to it.
So, all right, so there you go, Tallahassee. If you want to know how to fix red tide, just listen to the show. We'll tell you, okay? A completely natural fix for red tide. Let's just get a whole bunch of oysters, grow them up, keep putting them along the intercoastal, and that's going to solve your tourism problem, your dead fish problem. It's going to clean the water. It's going to take care of all that. And all we have to do is make some oyster beds. This was hard to figure out, guys. Okay, Tallahassee, pay attention. All right. Let's see. Freshwater fishing. Who's got what on freshwater?
The crappie fishing has picked up just a little tiny bit this week.
RJ's looking at me like, you just said that? Yes, Tallahassee, I just said that. Pay attention.
I'll go along
with it. Clams and oysters can fix all this red tide problem. It is completely natural, and it pays for itself after a few years. Take the $10 billion you're going to spend studying it, buy some oysters.
And they're tasty little buggers, too.
Yeah, for when there's no red tide.
That's right.
So
sure.
All right, I'm sorry.
Go back to freshwater.
This look on his face like, did you really say that, Frank? Yes, I did.
Not the first time I've heard it, so it didn't shock me at all. You know, the crappie fishing has picked up a little bit this week. But
leave it to Robert, just right out of it.
That's why he's here.
That's why he's here. Okay.
I would say that this weekend actually might be promising, even this next day or two, because we've had a pretty significant amount of rain. So I would think that maybe some of the spillways might be running a little bit more and just kind of reinvigorate the lacklustered crappie season we basically had. I mean, it's been good, but it hasn't been excellent.
It's been mushy, yeah.
Yeah.
We've been selling a ton of minnows. I think we've sold more minnows this year, I think, than we have in the last 5 years.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But nobody's talking about the crappie fishing. Either they got way, way more secretive.
Yeah, either something happened where they got lockjawed or they're just catching enough to keep them interested and enough to keep them fed, but not enough to be joyous about it.
Yeah, if I was judging it by how many minnows we're selling, I would say this is one of the best crappie season in years. But if I was judging it from what I heard on from people or the look on their faces, I'd say it's a pretty mediocre year in crappie.
Right, and I agree with you 100% on that.
About three guys have come in and said jig fishing is not great here this year.
Yeah.
They're not doing well on crappie jigs.
I've heard that from a couple different guys. One guy was in today getting some crappie minnows, and he's been fishing in the 9 Mile Canal, and he's got a little bank where he slides his canoe down, and he's been catching a couple using the little tiny hair jigs. But he was going to go try, because he's not catching numbers. He's just catching a couple here and there as he's trolling along behind the boat. So his goal today was to actually go try to troll up a couple and then stop and really focus on it with minnows and see if that makes a difference, because he's not able to jig them up. Once he's hooked one trolling by, he can't seem to find more in that same spot.
Any ideas why? I mean, jig fishing historically is pretty good here. Between the beetle spins, the marabou jigs, the curltail jigs, we usually go through a lot of jigs a year, and I'm not seeing the jig sales, and I'm not getting, these guys aren't excited. Any reason, RJ, you can think of?
No, I have no idea. I'm not much of a crappie fisherman. I've caught them on occasion. So I don't know, and I think there's a temperature thing going on right now where the water temperatures have dropped pretty quick, and maybe that slowed them down. But I haven't heard, there's a lot of guys in my neighborhood that crappie fish, and they're all saying basically the same thing. They catch one or two, and that's it.
It's kind of a mushy year on crappie.
Yeah,
it's not great. It's not completely horrible, but okay.
Yeah, not enough for them to want to hold a good conversation about. It's not that exciting.
You know, I had a guy call me up, and their idea behind a TV show was a hunt for this big fish. And I was like, okay, well, we can do that in a day. Now, what are you going to base the rest of the show on? They're like, what? I'm like, yeah. This year, I mean, there's just been a lot of big fish around. Even largemouth bass, there's a lot of bass around.
Yeah, I mean, the largemouth bass in our area right now have been averaging 3 to 4 pounds with the occasional 6 to 8 pounder.
Those are giants if you're coming down from up north.
Oh, yeah. But for, you know, this year in our area, it seems to be a little bit better quality bass than in the last couple of years past, as far as average size goes. And the majority of the people that are catching them are catching them on shiners. There's quite a few guys that have been playing with some of the different worms, some of the creature baits, spinner baits, lip baits. I mean, they're kind of throwing a mixed barrage at them. There doesn't seem to be a single pattern right now for the largemouth bass, but the shiners are definitely the key to it. And then depending on the canal system that you're in, most of the fish are in pre-spawn. but there's some areas where they're already starting to be in post-spawn. So you're seeing some fish on beds or building beds right now, and usually that's when you get your bigger fish.
You heard anything up by Deep Prairie Creek up here? That's the one with the dam and the lake. I think that's an awesome place to go.
It's a beautiful area.
I haven't heard anything about the fishing up there, but
not in probably several weeks or maybe even a couple months, honestly. But that would be an area close by to here that I would be checking without a doubt.
And you got the Turtle Preserve up there, which is kind of weird because the Turtle Preserve is far enough up the river where it's just fresh water, but like in the summertime, it's not uncommon to find little bull sharks all the way up that way.
Little bull sharks and tarpon on a regular basis up there
so
throughout the summer.
I'd almost think the tarpon would be up that far, looking for deeper holes. They tend to hit way up the rivers at this time of year. I wonder if the Turtle Preserve would have tarpon in it right now.
It wouldn't surprise me in the slightest, but they have been catching some snook and bass from basically just north of Snook Haven all the way up to the headwaters kind of right there. There's like a spill dam somewhere a long ways up.
Right.
I've only seen pictures of it, but I don't know where it's at. You know, Kirk was telling me about he used to go fish it all the time when he was a kid because he grew up there.
I would like to check Blue Ridge Park here in Northport. Now, that's got a big dam on it, that lake. It's got a real pretty park by it. It's right here in town. That Blue Ridge Park, to me, because if you could fish right below where the water's coming down,
right,
those bass, I would put a shiner under a bobber, probably about 2-3 feet, just where you could cast it good, and cast it into the falling water. The object is to try and get your bobber to go behind the falling water. Behind water, if you were ever a kid or now, I don't swim in around dams. I'm older and I think I'd break, but when I was a kid, we'd always swim up to the dam, go under the waterfall. As soon as you get behind it, there's no pull on the water.
It literally is
very calm. It doesn't pull you towards the water or push you away from it. We're out in front of the fall. For the first few feet, it's sucking you into the waterfall, and after you get out a few feet, it starts pushing away from the waterfall. But behind the waterfall, the water's actually perfectly still, and that's where a lot of those big fish like to lay. And if you can get your bobber to go behind that waterfall and get up there where it's dead still, even for just a minute or so, and that's when you're going to nail that big bass out from behind there. Because he's just laid up there waiting for something to come around and, you know, fall over the dam so he can eat.
Yeah. And especially right after that rain, that first, you know, several hours of that pouring over there, it's dislodged a lot of little bugs, lizards, everything. And critters flush right over that.
If I was going to do the crappie fishing, though, I wouldn't be trying to get my bait. I would try and put a nice size shiner on, get it behind the waterfall so it's sitting back there in that calm water on the backside of the fall underneath the waterfall. If I'm going to crappie fish there, what I'm looking for is I want that water falling down, but like I say, that first few feet is pulling the water towards the falling water. It actually is sucking the surface water down with the fall, so it actually takes you closer to it. What you want to look for is just out of the ways, look for that water coming back up and then starting to move away from the fall. That's the line I want to fish for the crappie. I don't want it where it's being sucked into the waterfall. I want it where the water's being pushed away from the waterfall. That's the edge where I want to cast that minnow under a bobber and kind of let it drift away from the fall. I want to cast up into it. If my bobber is going towards the waterfall, I'm going to reel it back so it starts moving away from the fall. That's where when I crappie fish or bluegills or anything on a dam like that, that's the water I'm looking for, the water moving away. If I want big fish, I'm trying to get under the waterfall. If I want more of the panfish, crappies, bluegills, whatever have you, I want it moving away from the falls.
Right, and the main reason for that is because a lot of those panfish are part of the food chain, so if they get too close to that spill water, the bass is going to eat them.
Yeah, you got big fish up there, so the smaller fish that are likely to be eaten by those or have grown up in the threat of being eaten by them are not going to want to go up there.
Yeah. Well, while we're talking about freshwater, Robert brought this up last week. He said peacock bass, and I was like, I didn't want to sound like an idiot and say, wait, we have peacock bass here? So I did all kinds of research reading up on peacock bass, and I didn't realize he'd come this far north. But if I wanted to get a peacock bass, where would I go? What would I do?
Naples is the closest place to consistently catch peacock. The problem is here, we have paku piranhas, we've got peacock bass, we have all that stuff. But every few years we get a really bad cold spell, and that wipes them way back.
Yeah, it's one of the things I read is they don't handle cold water at all.
So when the water gets like, they're like snook. Once it hits like 60 degrees, they're kind of done for. And this year would be very hard on all these subtropical species. But we always have a few, and years where we go like 10 years without a cold, cold winter, all of a sudden we got peacock bass, we've got a lot of paku piranhas, we've got all these exotics, but one cold spell, whoop, they get knocked back. And only the ones hanging out in the deepest of the lakes survive it. If they're in a canal that has 6 foot of water, they're not going to survive. They got to be in a lake or a body of water, a canal, where they can get down 10, 15 feet. They got to be really deep. In Miami, it's really funny, when you go to see the peacock bass, in the winter, they have some very, very low flat bridges for the cars, old concrete bridges, and that bridge abutment on both sides. When we were down there, you get underneath that bridge, it was probably 10 degrees hotter under those bridges than it was once you got outside of it. You know, if you have a bridge that's up off the water a good ways, it's always nice and cool and refreshing underneath there. Well, what we found in Miami, we have to duck to get underneath these bridges, maybe just sitting in a boat, they're about head high. It acts as a solar collector, that concrete gets hot, warms the water up, and that's why those peacocks survive in some of those Miami areas, is literally from the amount of concrete around those bridges. As it gets cold, they've got deep water, they've got big concrete sides that are just superheated during the day in the sun and radiate that heat all night. There are going to be no peacock out in the more natural areas. Any place there's not very low concrete bridges, there was no peacock bass.
Right.
So it's a radiator, a solar radiator, you know, keeping those bass alive. Where up here, they don't have those places to hide, so the cold weather comes in and knocks them out. But I can't think of any place up here that I can point to that would have...
No, nothing as far as peacocks go of any consistency. You'd have to literally...
Find
south
an old
of
gravel
Naples,
pit somewhere that...
South of Naples is going to be your best bet.
Yeah, down by Naples is your only consistent bet. I don't really know which of the canals are in.
All along Old 41.
All the ones along 41?
Yeah, along Old 41 they have some. But, I mean, if I really wanted to go catch a peacock bass, like today, and you told me I have to catch one, I'm going over to the West Palm, Fort Lauderdale area and fishing those canals, like Lake Ida, Lake Osborne, and then any of the canal systems in the Miami area, Homestead area, are completely saturated with them where you stand a chance.
Yeah, it's just... no consistency here to them because of the water temperature.
And the species of peacock bass we have here, there's like four or five species, and the ones that the Game and Fish did release here was a butterfly peacock, which is the smallest of the species of peacock bass. So we don't have those giant ones like you see like these Amazon fishing shows.
Yeah.
All right. Does red tide cause barnacles to grow?
I would say yes. I think it's going to be helpful with the barnacle growth because of the amount of death that it's going to cause to make all the little filter feeders happy. And a barnacle is basically a tiny, tiny shrimp that builds himself or floats around and then glues himself to some type of structure and then sits there and filter feeds little micro and macro algae and planktons in the water. So if there's higher nutrient levels in the water, I think it's going to make it a better environment for barnacles.
We've got a lot of fish in the intercoastal. We've talked about different stuff. and why they might be in the area hardest hit by the red tide, I'm going to go with my number one reason is the shrimp migration's going on. We're getting some of the biggest shrimp we've seen in years. They're all moving out of Charlotte Harbor right now. The intercoastal waterway is literally loaded with shrimp. There's got to be millions upon millions upon millions of shrimp in the intercoastal waterway. And when the guys are fishing under the docks, they're behind Cayo Costa, Cayo Gasparilla and all that. Shrimp is the number one bait.
Absolutely.
I think they're just there because that's where the best trout stuff is, the biggest trout, the redfish, all these fish. I think they're just there eating shrimp. And I don't know that it had anything to do with the red tide. But it was interesting to speculate because when you hear it on the news, there's going to be no fish there forever. And right now it's been the best fishing. What's going on in the harbor, Robert? Any trout up in the harbor?
They're starting to pick up a couple here and there, but they're still pretty slim pickings. The majority of the trout are down along the intercoastal once again. Just this week, I've actually finally gotten a few better reports, especially up there in Lemon Bay. Some of the mouths of the canals going into the developments, they're starting to pick up a few in that 16 to 20 inch range. And then down there in Pine Island Sound, especially down towards Captiva Rocks and towards just south of Captiva Pass itself along the ICW and some of those deeper grass flats, seems to be where the consistent numbers are coming from. But even then, it's still a little on the sketchy side, but it has at least gotten a few more reports this week compared to the last several weeks.
All right. Got to tip the hat to RJ's original explanation about why they would be there in the food, and there could be just a lot of shrimp this year because of the red tides that we had, all the extra food for them, and it's a simple creature. The more you feed it, the faster it grows. The more you feed it, the bigger it gets. It molts its shell. Every time it gets full, it gets feeding up. And at least once a month, it loses its entire outer body the way a blue crab. You picture a soft shell crab, same thing the shrimp does. The head falls off, the body falls off. It's a big mushy blob. It grows a little bit bigger, gets hard, and takes off going again. And so you might have hit it right on the head there. I think the only reason there's so many fish there is because there's so much food, the biggest shrimp migration we've had in years. If you're going to go shrimping, now is the time. But you need to be there on outgoing water. So that means getting there at high tide. If you get there low tide, it's over, boys and girls. Then the water's going to come in. You want to get there about an hour or two before high tide. Has to be after dark. The fuller the moon, the better. But you need to bring bright lights and dip nets. Anyway, we'll go into more of that a little bit. Let's see, Gulf of Mexico, what's going on?
Gulf of Mexico, basically what's going on out there is your lane snapper have been really the big talk, along with some porgies and some sheep's head from 10 to 20 miles, with your best numbers being in that 10 to 15 miles, but your little bit better quality size-wise is out there at about 20 miles. They're getting lane snapper up to 2.5 to 3 pounds, and then they're getting some porgies and grunts and some sheep's head up into the 2 to 4 pound range, even some sheep's head I heard of that were in the 5 pound, 6 pound range, which is pretty decent. Until you get out further into the Gulf, the numbers have been all over the map as far as the red grouper goes. One guy does good in 80 feet of water, and the next guy isn't finding grouper until he's into 110, 120 feet of water after making several stops trying to find them in that closer distance. But they're getting red grouper up to 30, 32 inches out there, which is really nice. They are still picking up a few gag grouper, which are closed. You need to be aware of that. So basically, when you're going out there, you're looking for red grouper and just some of the different snappers and porgies for the most part. The AJs I haven't heard much about. Haven't heard of any cobia to speak of. I've heard of one king mackerel, and he was a little guy. He was like 10 pounds. So the pelagics have not been super cooperating.
What's the bait that they're using out there?
The main bait for the snapper and the porgies and stuff like that is shrimp. Shrimp's by far the key thing. A couple guys have been using the fish bites out there as far as taking some artificial stuff. And then some squid, some cut sardines. The red grouper primarily being caught on squid and sardines because there's believe it or not, with as much life as there is in the intercoastal, the near shore shallow areas where guys are used to catching pinfish and blue runners and stuff in that 20 to 30 feet of water range, they're actually having a difficult time finding squirrel fish, pinfish, and blue runners to take with them out there for bait.
How about octopus? Anybody using octopus?
Octopus is an unbelievable bait to use. It costs a little bit more than the squid does, but it stays on the hook so much better than anything else. The guys, once they start to use it, they'll almost everyone I know of that has gone from squid to octopus stays with the octopus as much as they can get it. Unless they got a lot of guys who just don't know what they're doing and are constantly breaking off their rigs.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with the bait.
Right. So, you know, it's octopus has definitely by far been really good. And we've also had a lot of guys buying the silver sides, taking those out to do some snapper fishing with too, which has always been a great bait to catch your yellowtail snapper, your lane snapper, and your mangrove snapper. But a lot of guys also use that to chum with. They'll use the glass minnows in conjunction with silver sides in their chum slick to really get those snapper all fired up. It works out pretty good.
And octopus is pretty much renewable, right?
It's a pretty renewable resource, yeah. I mean, an average octopus only lives about 1 year. You know, from the day it's born to the day it dies, and especially the Gulf octopus, I don't know the exact name of it, they only live a year. There's a couple other species that'll live 2 years, and then I think it's the giant Pacific octopus. I think its average lifespan is like 5 to 7 years. It's a very, very short lifespan.
But they reproduce really quickly.
Several years ago, I guess it was probably about 4 or 5 years ago, where the stone crabbers were having a brutal, brutal time with their stone crabs because there was like a major octopus population growth. They were decimating their traps. I mean,
if octopus lived 10 or 12 years, they would take over the ocean.
Oh, yeah, there'd be nothing left on the bottom of the ocean, yeah.
Because, A, they're strong.
I mean, they eat everything.
They eat anything in front of them or that they can grab hold of. And, B, unbelievably intelligent.
Oh, super intelligent.
Any sci-fi movie that talks about when, humans aren't around anymore, the common consensus is octopus or maybe a squid or octopus creature would be the first one to come out of the water and take over for us.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be studying these, you know, apes that used to wander around the land.
Yeah, I hear they drive Fords, too.
They drive Fords?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure I get the joke. I'm a little out of time, but that's all right. All right. Let's see. We got to wrap it up. There's probably going to be music playing. The fishing's not bad right now, but no one really knows for sure because of all of the wind,
weather,
the rain, all this. So hopefully the fishing out there is excellent. We just can't get to it till the weather's over. But Fish and Frank here thinking it's great fishing out there and everything's wonderful, even though I don't know for sure. Robert in the chair across me, RJ in the control booth. We think it's a great day to go fishing. Not really. Wait till tomorrow, the day after.